Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're continuing our investigation into the ways that AI is informing ecosystems across industry and society and exploring how we design pathways to resilient futures. I'm Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shoshimworks, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Mark Stephen Meadows, science fiction writer and researcher for NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. By way of introduction, I'm a sailor, I'm an author, I'm an artist, entrepreneur, and an inventor. But I've spent the last couple decades of my life in artificial intelligence and which is to say real-time 3D virtual worlds and avatars, about 10 years in blockchain, and I've worked as CEO or CTO for a number of companies. It was at a lecture, I think it was at Yale, might have been Oxford, maybe 15 years ago, I ran into a gentleman there who was able to articulate really complicated notions in super simple packages. And I realized, like, I wanted to be friends with this guy. So we've been in touch ever since. We are welcoming to the podcast today Phil D. Hall, who is the CTO for Care Enabler, for Syracuse, and he's a pioneer in AI. I think he's been working to create leading edge human to cyberspace interactions, internal or external facing. And Phil, please, if you would tell us a little about yourself.
I'm Phil D. Hall. It's a common name, Phil Hall, so I emphasize the D, so it's easier to find me. I've been working in conversational AI since a long time ago. 1982, I built my first on a ZX Spectrum, which was possibly a little bit ahead of the game. And you and I crossed paths, Mark. It was in Cambridge at the Special Interest Group in AI, as I was coming out from systems integration work with Logica, and the Y2K piece was sort of there and bubbling about. So you and I have known each other a long time, and we've had discussions which underpin where the flow of conversation goes. We discussed cigars, did we not? Yeah, and cigar-shaped conversational structures in Paris. But I've always worked with the best of breed components and methodologies and been lucky enough to come across some truly amazing people over the many decades I've been doing this conversational AI piece. And right now I'm feeling like my personal focus points, which are engineering, electrical, mechanical engineering, social science, and most importantly, human-led development of systems, AI systems, but systems more broadly, is more important than ever. So yeah, a long introduction, I suppose, really, but super glad to be here and really cool to talk.
Yeah, it's great to catch up. I mean, the weekend, just the weekend alone with OpenAI shenanigans and the board of directors, comparing that crazy, psychotic turn of events with all their work and companies that you and I have touched on, going all the way back to some of your early work in 99, there's been a lot of changes, right? And up at this, creating some of the most future-forward concepts of threading artificial intelligence in with virtual augmented reality, where do you see things going? I mean, can you share your vision and how AI is a part of that? How do we look forward and with a perspective of the past, reconcile these things?
I think that's a 10,000 insert major currency kind of question, Mark. The ability to look forward and look backwards at the same time is actually, I think, the nub of what we need to do here. The piece that I'm interested in is the hybrid element of it. I think this kind of human-led hybrid system where you can use artificial intelligence as something which is in part mechanical, electrical, engineering, and on the other side, probabilistic and statistical. And I think the piece in the middle, the hybrid piece, is the piece that's most fascinating right now because, you know, with a few over 700 people at OpenAI who decided to write the letter earlier on, which is the latest part of this Shakespearean drama.
Yeah.
I think we're in a position where a small amount of people are making quite a large amount of action right now. What's really interesting and what I think is visionary right now, because we could get on a horse here about who runs things. Yeah. We could get on a horse here about, you know, who has the control. What is the surveillance? Was there a sort of a glance towards you own your own work, you know, at the birth of the internet before everybody decided that, as Larry Ellison said, I think, wasn't it? There's no privacy, get over it. So I think there's some interesting stuff coming towards our shared vision, Mark, from what we've looked at, particularly with respect to the total immersion with the VR piece.
Yeah.
That kind of the iAvatar piece from years gone by. I saw one of those tray-like constructs, mechanical constructs with people walking in VR space. And I was like, maybe this is coming now. Maybe there's some kind of an edge. I'm not sure how artificial intelligence works on that outside of the graphics side. Actually, let me throw that one back to you, Mark. The graphic side for AI and the conversational part for AI, sure, they're using sort of similar methodologies, but what's your view of the graphic side right now?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me an inevitable future that we're going to be putting a face on these things. We're already anthropomorphizing them. We've had a lot of conversations, you and I, about what is the personality as the user interface to AI. The fact that there's conversations that are being driven primarily with just text-based interfaces with ChatGPT or Claude or Bard, that's what we were seeing with the early chatbots. And so as humans, we've got these really old pieces of hardware between our ears that we're used to be able to see things like facial expressions and hear things like intonation and tonality. And so whether we anthropomorphize these things consciously or not, there's some part of our brain that's going to be looking or hungry for that sort of an interaction. I mean, it's great to just like get like text messages back from ChatGPT, but multimodality is being discussed more and more now. And I think that as we look at healthcare applications or as we look at educational applications, language learning, the way in which we say things becomes very important. Just language learning alone. If I say, I love doing podcasts, that's certainly different than if I say, I love doing podcasts. These are like, the words don't change, right? So we've got to figure out how do we package the message so that we increase the meaning.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the meaning and the meaning as opposed to different people is something that we're doing right now. So the folks that I'm working with currently, as I look towards the end of what I want to do business-wise in this space for various reasons, is making meaningful delivery of systems to diverse people. Yeah. And I mean diverse on the sense of sort of diversity and inclusion, protected characteristics within our region. I'm talking about sort of, you know, ESGs. I'm talking about how do you deliver type 2 diabetes information to somebody whose food and culture and relationship with authority or education or entertainment is entirely different from somebody else. Yeah. Now, there's a really interesting juicy piece there, Mark, which you and I know about, this sort of machine translation piece. Yeah. There's a really interesting piece there, which is about the social and cultural variance and how you actually capture that. And having done, we worked in all the major sectors, the fintech and the utilities and charities, and you and I work quite deeply in education and look to try and reset that bar of where the value is in the conversation which is generated. The healthcare piece is the bit that's got me so by the sort of by the attention points right now. Yeah, exactly. And the reason why, and this is a piece of research which we're doing, which is not Seracares. Seracares is about giving people status, wearing computers, caring with people in a low-status environment. So that's about wrapping information with the support of people to give them better confidence and henceforth being better people in the world. Yeah. But the piece that is the healthcare architecture, which I'm most excited about, and we're halfway through this piece, is a system we're calling ROMI, Relational Online motivational interventions. On board with it, we have universities, three universities, diabetologist. It's funded by the National Institute of Health Research over here in the UK. And over a period of a year, we're looking to create a structured and layered analysis of interaction, a bit like you and I were chatting about 10, 15 years ago, semantic and sentiment analysis. Because if you go to somewhere like Hugging Face, you'll end up with, what was the figure? It nearly blew my mind, 400,000 or 40,000 or whatever, an enormous amount of open source, which is a good thing, models doing very simple things. And none of them are actually that new at the end of the day. Yeah. So I think trying to sort of break out of the it's all in a magic box and get to a position where it's about transparency is probably the most interesting piece for me right now. I mean,
let me rewind for a bit, though, because let's take a look at the healthcare example. I mean, your work with Echo Borg, for example, where you have people really, it's hard to tell the line between where the AI system is running, public installations where people can't really tell, is this a person or is this AI? And in fact, that's sort of the whole point, is that AI is a reflection of us. So I want to try to go around sort of what are the ethical implications of this. And I want to, if we can go back to a use case that you mentioned, let's say that there's somebody who's just emigrated to London from Suriname and their English is good, but they're dealing with a whole bunch of different contextual layers and they've got type 2 diabetes. Do we take information, healthcare information that we've collected from other participants in maybe a third-party system, and feed that means of communicating? Let's say there's other people from Suriname who've also moved to London that also have type 2 diabetes. Do we use those past conversations and actually salt the data for our example end user with other people's information so they get really highly contextualized blended data that's been machine learned, machine taught by humans?
Yeah, I'd like to say,
no, privacy is more important.
Yeah, no, I'd like to jump in on that as well. This is along the lines of the question that was top of mind for me listening to Phil. I think these capabilities offer us the ability to create greater alignment between knowledge and context and outcomes, right? The context is a critical part that can get lost with very domain specific applications. And these capabilities allow us to create complex configurations that align the context, the perceptions, the knowledge, and the outcomes, and drive better configurations of the experience and the outcomes. So Phil, maybe just tagging on to Mark's question, how do we configure basically a solution set, a system of solutions that wrap all of these knowledge components into better outcomes for the patients or for the actors in the system?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think I was involved in a conversation on Monday between our practicing health psychologist and our diabetologist about the utilization of COMBI, which is a behavioral modification method, which is using a similarly kind of really useful high-level knowledge management, to go back a few years, kind of perspective, knowledge, context, outcomes. And I think that as I sat being the sort of ethnographer on the side of that conversation, I came out with a cascading set of structures, which was about social and cultural dialing of the delivered messages of, as we did with TeachBot back 15 years back now, concatenating more than one response into an element. But the starting point, and this is one of those elements that we're asking of directly in the workshops, which is feeding to the report, which will feed to further funding so that we can work out how to do a random control trial of a conversational AI system, which is a conundrum possibly for another day. One of the direct questions we're asking people, and we're working with hard to reach areas, South Asian ladies, Sudanese taxi drivers, retirement home folks, which again are sort of fringes, yeah, and we're asking them, what would you share? Would you share within your family? Would you want your uncle or aunt to have the same information or no? Would you share with your local GP? Would you share with your nation? Would you share internationally? And of course, news today in the UK is that Palantir, the organization, has got the federal data service on the basis of paying a dollar for the COVID work they did. So there's some really heavy duty discussions going on right now, Diane. But I think that the way to do it is to start from a position of you own your own words, and to deal with people the same way as you would do if you met them in real life. And I might meet you in a restaurant or an opera, who can say, and we might chat, and you'd say something, and I'd say, that's brilliant, do you mind if I use that? And you'd say, yes, probably, because I hope I was being charming. But, you know, you'd have the rights. And I think that's possibly where we are with the ethics piece at the moment, is that nobody's really thought about the rights. They've thought about the rights to profit rather than the rights to draw in the information. What do you think, Diane?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And listening to you too, I think about the BCI capabilities that are now beginning to really kind of show up in a pretty strong way. So do we extend that to you own your own thoughts, right? Is there a principle of cognitive liberty? If you followed Nita Faraday, she is a leading voice in this cognitive liberty kind of conversation. So do we also extend that to thoughts as the BCI kind of comes into a more mainstream application set of applications?
I think that actually goes back a couple of steps to looking forwards and backwards, because when I was sitting building the first chatbot on the ZX Spectrum, I was reading about semiconductors, and I was reading about BCI, alpha, beta, theta wave recognition, and how it was going to be a revolution. And there are a lot of revolutions that people who are a little longer in the tooth have seen over this time, Diane. I think I got asked a real fastball in a local technical meeting in Bristol, which is just north of where I am in the southwest of the UK. And somebody said, because I think the kind of biases embedded within data, which are embedded within the language models, whether they're open source or not. Yeah. And let's come back to, what is that? Is that a block of stone? Is that a pool, a lake, an IBM kind of lake of stuff kind of thing? And anyhow, so this was coming up, and somebody knew I was sitting at the back being the ethnographer, watching what was going on. And they said, so what do we do with the data, Phil? And off the top of my head, without thinking, I just said, get rid of it. Start again. And everybody went, wow, and sort of half burst out laughing. But yeah, it is. It's one of those, okay, so hold on a second. At what point do we find a historical precedent? Because we've all heard the same things, haven't we? Artificial intelligence and human beings. I heard this from a fella who is well-respected in healthcare, speaks a lot. It's the second big bang. Now, in the UK, the big bang was when we digitized our financial markets. So I'm sitting at the back of this gig here, and I'm thinking, what's it got to do with the second? Oh, no, he meant the birth of the universe is the same level as artificial intelligence plus humans. And I think that these kind of statements should be in some way illegal or at the very least immoral. I personally see large language models and these kind of GPU-enhanced vector-based construct as blocks of stone that people are trying to carve things out of, right? But I don't see the stone as moving. There's no sort of Terminator kind of special effects going on here. It's just a block of stone. It's guessing what's going to do next. How do you see the large language models and these kind of constructs? Mark, what's your take, man?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the analogy for oil is probably a pretty good one. It seems to me to be an often toxic layer at the top. Beautiful rainbow swirling around. It looks like you want to get in, but then you're like, wait, what really is that? If data is the new oil, I think it's judicious to just like dump it, burn it, dispose. Been collected in illegal means that aren't valuing how other people have been choosing to live their lives and share their information. Below that layer, I think there's something that is really valuable, but they're striated layers. And after we have that first potentially toxic layer that so many companies are trying to get rid of, we then end up with a more homogeneous material, but still lumped together, essentially topics within a vector space. We're going to have clusters of information that glue together in blobs. At least that's where people have explored culturally. And then as you get down to a layer that is almost just grammatical, you have this completely homogeneous, let's call it a fungible layer. And I think that most of us don't take the time to go and swim around down there. And that is, I think, also something that's really dangerous, because people say, oh, well, it's a black box. And once we've got our response generated, nobody really knows where it came from. But that's really just laziness. You and I have both seen tools when we, like now we have bulldozers that can push huge amounts of data forward. But there was a time when you and I had to go through, we were having to train individual words and link individual words to other words using WordNet and other systems. And so I think it's a matter of looking at this toxic layer that has some homogeneous and gradually fungible material below it, and saying we need to be able to mine this more accurately so that we're properly sorting the data and allowing a traceability. Who said that? Who actually, like Wikipedia, who produced that individual phrase? Was that Diane or Phil or Mark? And it should have provenance attached to it. So I'm going to go with the liquid metaphor. There's a big bulldozer on the side shoving more mud in. Diane? You want to take a whack at this one?
Yeah, I love it. Let's just chase the metaphor, shall we? And I like the artistry of it, right? So this is a and basically a new capability, that a set of new capabilities that are becoming available and much more ubiquitous, right? And we have the opportunity to basically unlock. We've been talking about the artist, the craftsman, to basically lift the value out of the material. And some of that material is going to be shed for the outcomes that we're looking for. Other of those material inputs are valuable in different configurations. But we should understand the craft. We should understand the material. We should understand what is being used and what configuration, and understand what is being shed for those outcomes and with those configurations. So it's, to me, it's artistry, it's science, and it should be, the experience and the outcomes should be the result of intentional decisions and not just speeding along with an implicit trust in kind of how we get there. The black box it's not a responsible path forward, right? We need to understand what the materials are, what choices have been made in order to configure the experiences and the outcomes. To that point, we all hear the hype, right? And that these capabilities are an existential threat. They're the next big bang, whatever that hype might be. That hype is intended, I'm sure, to be quite inspirational, but to your point, Phil, also irresponsible. We need to kind of walk this down into a practical, fundamental understanding of the tools, the toolkits, and the possible outcomes, and how to craft better outcomes, whether that's healthcare, education, science, whatever that might be. So that's, I guess, my perspective, Mark. Does that make sense? I know we're all, to some degree, artists here, but I keep coming back to my artist kind of orientation.
Yeah. So like if you're at the opera and you ask somebody if you can use that particular line and they say yes or no, there needs to be some guardrail reinforcement for that, right? The fact that whatever, Reddit or take your pick, where there's a lot of conversations, is such a nice harvestable field, is mainly because there aren't guardrails that are there. And I mean, there's a long tradition of people going out and like mowing the neighbor's yard and collecting the fruit that's there and then selling it at the market. I think that I've had this kind of problem lately because the more that I review literature on existential threats, the less I'm seeing it as being something that needs to be worried about. Now, what I was doing to try to get a handle on this is look at how calculators were coming into use. That we mentioned this earlier on a podcast with James, and I'm thinking, are we really facing some kind of evil system that's about to brew up and bite us all or try to take down the human race because we're bad for the planet? Or is this a convenient pocket calculator and we're going to be calculating words and using it like a calculator, like the access to calculate math, the means of doing that has gotten cheaper over time. And when the electronic calculator came out, I think it was like the 60s and 70s, there was a pretty significant technological hop, right? A lot of people were awed. A lot of people were skeptical. A lot of people said this is going to be the end of business. And we have articles that we can find in the New York Times. So the reputable sources were saying, like, this is the end. But it wasn't. And now, as we use calculators on a daily basis for now natural language processing, we can see that there's more opportunities for learning, more opportunities for inventing new kinds of chemical weapons, more opportunities for learning languages, more opportunities for duplicitous political speech. But I don't think in the end that the existential threat, you know, I guess like last weekend, it was that there was a loss function at OpenAI that one of the senior engineers found. It seems as though part of what has happened over there, and I'm just gaining this, I wasn't there to see it, I'm just gaining this from some people I know that work there, is that GPT-5 is presenting a lot of new possibilities, and that there's a loss function that was showing, like, generally the GPT models, 4 in particular, have been just like a little bit ahead of Claude, but looking, there was some really substantial breakthrough on this that was seen on Thursday night. And that then that was part of what generated it caused things to come to a head. Now, whether that really happened or not is irrelevant, because AGI is going to happen. Like, okay, what time is it now? We're going to see ethical lines breached, and there'll be religious outcries. There will be really big economic upheavals, more because of the psychology of people than the presence of the machine. But at the same time, in your work, Phil, you've always looked at how these pieces mesh together. Your work, if anything, has looked at the hybridization and the fact that AI is a reflection of people and we a reflection of it.
Yeah, I do totally. And I think the one of those pieces about where do we go and where does a calculator, a mechanical calculator fit in? When does a digital calculator fit in? If we go back to the beginning of electricity, there was natural electricity from electric eels and artificial electricity, literally. Yeah, so we're in that kind of a threshold, yeah, and we're sort of wondering which way it's going to go. And much though I am hugely irritated by the quality and quantity of traditional media, I won't even open social media on this point, yeah, traditional media about are you scared yet, humans, and this kind of information that's coming through from reputable sources within my region. I think sometimes we've got to go back and look a little bit more deeply at literature from when the robots was the revolution, from Heinlein, from Stranger in a Strange Land, from the ability for people to take a state of mind where they could not tell a falsity, yeah, to go back to Foundation Trilogy and to go, okay, so planetary scientists, okay, so isn't that sort of where we are and what does a mule look like? And then when you actually sit and talk to people who are not within the bubble and you ask them about artificial intelligence, you're then able to start a different level of conversation with them. You're able to gather some parameters and look at what the tools that are going to be needed to be able to deal with the information delivery mechanisms. Because I think the calculator is a great line. I was in a charity shop recently looking for something to put my wife's shoes on, and I came across the Encyclopedia Britannica just there, right in front of me, for £40, right? 19 copies of it, yeah. And I was slightly shocked and nearly bought it on impulse, because I'm sure I can fit it on these bookcases somehow. But equally, I remember the shock of seeing that the first time, of having it in my house when I was in my 20s. Everything I Want to Know is in there, and it was connected. Shock of the internet. Shock of the search engines as they got better. Shock of Google before it went off the rails, in my humble opinion. For me, the generative AI piece and the large language models are just the latest shock, and I don't see them as any significant step forwards. AGI, Mark, totally agree. It's a different conversation, but at what point do you say the Turing test has been beaten? Because when I delivered systems to a television company 15 years ago, people would say, wow, you're answering that question quickly, when it was a chatbot before they got corrupted in terms and so on. So I think it's one of those, let's see who's driving, I think, rather than where we're driving to, maybe.
Yeah, this question of, who's got the wheel, who's on which side of the surveillance camera, who gets to write the line that's being read? These are the ethical issues, and I think it's good for us to slowly evaluate this and with a healthy dose of skepticism. I mean, like, look, existential problems are exciting, right? It's like somebody walks into my house with a gun. Like, that's exciting, but it doesn't mean that it's the kind of thing that I need to spend all my days worrying about.
We're about to wrap it up. So I think this is super important. And yeah, I really like the point that you made earlier. I do think that these tools, these advanced technologies are in fact a reflection of us and vice versa, right? So similar to all of the great innovation we've seen across the ages, humanity will rise up and reach for that next chapter and that next generation of kind of what it means to be human for within society, within industry, within policy. We will apply these innovations to improve the human experience and outcomes. And I think that this is just another renaissance moment for humanity. We have the possibility to craft meaningful improvements across multiple domains. We can see how this can play out in education, in science, in healthcare, in finance, right? In order to create more prosperity, more innovation, healthier outcomes, but we have to embrace it with the right mindset, right?
Yep.
There are certainly potentially negative outcomes, but there are incredibly rich, beneficial outcomes. And
yeah, it occurs to me that maybe as the calculator helped us understand the AGI, maybe AGI and natural language processing will help us understand new kinds of mathematics.
Yeah.
And with that right. New kind of mathematics, we then open up more possibilities. So yes,
yeah, right.
I like that.
Phil, this has been incredible. Thank you so much for joining us today and for kind of shaking up our thinking in this arena. And we'll continue this conversation, no doubt, in the conversations next week with the team. But we appreciate your time here, your perspective, and the amazing work that you're leading. So we will follow along in your digital exhaust and keep an eye on your work and your worldview. Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Loads of fun conversation. Take care now.
Excellent.
Take care. Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out the season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts for your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shoshimworks.com.